Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rocherolle, the chef in the hat.
As usual, we're coming to you from the Hawkstone Society here in downtown Seattle. Thanks for tuning in. Hopefully you're probably not in your garden much anymore, and you're closing things up for the winter. But maybe you're in your kitchen larding your pantry like I did a couple weekends ago. Or maybe you are just making dinner for your honey. Or maybe you're on the exercise bike at a podcast just listening away, thinking about how horrible this bike ride is, but how good dinner is going to taste afterwards.
You're getting ready for Thanksgiving. Lose the pound before you gain them.
I am chef owner of several Seattle restaurants, including the one we're above here, Lola. And, of course, Palace Kitchen, Dahlia Lounge, which is turning 30 years old on November the 15th.
Happy birthday, Tom.
Thank you.
It's very well deserved. I'm Thierry Rocherolle, chef in the hat, owner of Luc in Madison Valley, and Lule downtown Seattle, corner of 6th and Union at the bottom of the Sheraton Grand.
Mm.
And this time of the year, it is rocking.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Speaking of, it always amazes me that Dahlia is turning 30 years old, considering how much we didn't even think we were going to hit 30 weeks, much less 30 years. So
no, it's true.
It was such a struggle in the beginning. I cherished those days because they were great learning lessons, but I don't miss them a whole lot.
No.
Other than going home with my honey and, you know, she was pregnant at the time we opened, and it was a real emotional time in our lives in general. But I don't miss that struggle, that trying to make payroll.
Well, there's a little bit of a beauty in the struggle that, you know, your soul is really happy doing that. But your bank account is better later on.
Good life lessons. We're going to talk a little bit about the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project that's coming up around Seattle, over 100 local restaurants taking part. Terry, my favorite immigrant, is right here standing right next to me. We have sumo wrestlers in the studio today. Ooh, this is so exciting because what do sumo wrestlers do?
They eat a lot.
And we like people who eat. And so we're going to find out what they eat to keep so big.
You know what else? They eat a lot, but they don't move a lot. And I kind of like the idea of like eating and laying down on the couch.
That's a pretty good wrestle going on, isn't it? When they're moving. Brittany Bartleben, chef of the Dahlia Bakery and Dahlia Lounge itself, is going to be here for the Baker's Corner to share tips on poaching pears. And, it's of course, we're going to finish the show, as we always do, with our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. I'm very excited for today's show. Let's jump into Ordinary to Extraordinary Chef. And I'm going to ask you a question about mashed potatoes, but I want to be very specific about this Ordinary to Extraordinary. So we all know how to make mashed potatoes. And the one way that I would say is that don't boil your potatoes
Correct. In
water and then drain the water and then make your mashed potatoes, right? I like to just, if I'm going to add cream later, I'm going to cook them in the cream, blah, blah, blah. But there's a specific potato from the country of France that is very famous called the Robuchon mashed potato.
Mm-hmm.
And would you tell our folks what percentage of butter is in Mr. Robuchon's, Chef Robuchon's mashed potatoes?
42%. So if you do 5 pounds of potato,
mm-hmm.
you do about 2 pounds of butter.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have cream too. So it is a very unctuous, delicious, smooth to the tongue mashed potato. It is not rugged. It is not.
mm-hmm.
It has everything like silk. It is delicious. Mm-hmm. But it also, you have to choose the potato. You use the rat potato, la rat potato, which is a little long,
little waxy potato.
Mm-hmm. That's important, too, because some potatoes will absorb, like when you cook them in water, like you were saying, not cook them, but if you cook them in water, it will absorb much more water, some of them will, than others. So those don't actually absorb as much water.
And so the idea, that mashed potato will actually break like mayonnaise breaks. Right? If you
Correct.
Add too much butter to it.
Any potato will. I mean, saturation of fat exists. So if you put too much, it will break.
So when I say it breaks, it means that the fat separates from the whey. And
the cream help the when you put a reduction of cream into your potato along with your butter, it helps stabilize the whole thing and helps it saturate at a higher point.
Mm-hmm.
So
when I've seen this potato made, I've seen it in big 20-quart Hobart mixers, you know, the big, it's like a large KitchenAid. And then they turn it on in with your cooked potatoes and add the butter and add the butter and add the butter and keep adding. And that potato is whipped for sometimes 40 minutes, 50 minutes, many thousands of revolutions.
Yeah, that's not my way of doing it. For me is I drain the potato.
Mm-hmm.
If by any chance they're a little bit too wet, I put them in the oven for about 2 minutes just to get rid of that excess steam and water. And then I put them in the Hobart machine. I put my reduced cream. My cream is already reduced. I put the cream in the potato. Nothing is moving yet. I put all my small cube. I make small cube butter. And the reason you do this, it's so it incorporates faster. If you make big chunks of butter, it takes much longer to melt and to be incorporated. So that you avoid, what I'm trying to avoid when I make a mashed potato is to actually mash the potato too long because it becomes elastic.
Well, yeah, so we'll just have to agree to disagree on that.
Nah, it's just.
I would say if you put it into a food processor, I totally agree with you. It becomes very elastic and stringy and gross. But if you put it into the mixer with a paddle, it doesn't get that way.
Okay. Well, you can try both and see what happens. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That would be my suggestion. But I'm trying not to overwhip. So I put everything in the bowl. Everything is super hot. The potatoes are still very hot. So instantly, the butter is going to start melting. And by paddling it, it just incorporates it right away. And finish with salt and pepper.
Mm-hmm.
I want to try to avoid moving it as much as possible. The other better way to do it, especially at home when you're not doing big volume, is to do it in one of those, what do you call those, Tom?
The food mill.
Food mill.
Uh-huh.
A food mill is actually...
Or a ricer.
A ricer, yeah. No, ricer is like this, right?
Yeah.
Food mill is the moulinet, yeah. So I would use a food mill at home to make the perfect mashed potato, only because it doesn't move the potato as much in terms of elasticity. And those are really great tools. So put all your potato in there, put your butter, put your cream, and then start mulling the whole potato.
Now, with a potato with that much fat, can you reheat it or does it want to break?
Well, when you reheat it, you have to be very careful because
like a double boiler, right?
It will want to separate.
Yeah.
So I would recommend, check this out, I would recommend microwave and then a little beating to it.
Never heard this before.
I know, because the microwave heats from the inside out, so it will eat your cells of your potato. It will have a little separation. Then you take a whisk and just do a quick whisking and you'll have a perfect mashed potato again.
So awesome. I would also suggest that this is a meal that are mashed potatoes that you don't want to serve at Thanksgiving. It's too rich. This you want to serve with something else. With a mashed potato is the star.
Whatever.
Okay. I'm just saying.
Whatever.
Up next, your culinary quandaries. You asked and we answered on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. This is the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're live here at the Hot Stove Society. And I just passed around, Chef, we've talked about fruitcake on the show a number of times. And yesterday evening, my wife got together all of the stuff that we've been putting together. We had June Taylor, blood orange, skin, what's the?
Rind.
Good call, Jan. rind and lemon rind, Meyer lemon rind, and dates and almonds and toasted pecans and macerated cherries. We macerated the whole thing in apple brandy. And then all the fruit, and then she made the cake batter and put it together last night. And here is the day after, the morning after fruitcake, that everyone seems to hate fruitcake. But can you tell me, does anyone, everyone just tried it, does anyone hate that?
No, it's delicious.
How many people hate fruitcake?
Not
one? Yeah, so, but a lot of people hate fruitcake, and I just don't get it. So we brought in some homemade fruitcake with real fruit, not a bunch of candied maraschino red and green cherries.
No, I mean, that's the whole thing. It's just like a lot of things. People they have a memory, a childhood memory of beets that you buy in a can. Mm-hmm. Or they have this damn cake that people used to buy also in a can.
To help the blind.
Yeah, and it was dry.
Okay. Well, this is a little dry this morning. So now I'll take this fruitcake. It's been out of the oven now for 12 hours. We'll take this. It's got a lot of apple brandy in it, but now I'm going to soak it in either Irish whiskey or some Calvados or something like that, wrap it in cheesecloth, and then put it in the fridge, and it'll just sit there and start to age. And you can let that age as long as you keep soaking it every couple of months and turning it.
I have a question. It's a little bit loose, so you have a lot of fruit and you have a lot of nuts, so maybe a little bit less?
No, I would say, I would add maybe 10% to 20% more
cake
batter than this one has.
Do you leave it on the counter for a couple of days to dry out first before you start soaking
it?
No, you don't.
No.
Okay. Because I used to do that.
You cook it long enough that it gets a nice crust on it, though.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool.
So
it
anyway,
is absolutely scrumptious, delicious. Yeah. I would eat that.
I mean, what's not to like, right? It's fruit and berries and
I mean, you can really taste the nuts in there.
All right, we have questions from our listeners. By the way, I'm Tom Douglas,
and I'm Terry Roturo, the chef in the hat.
Jan has joined us at the microphone from our audience. Jan, what is your question?
Well, my question is actually my mom's question, but Ginger's shy and didn't want to come up. But I've been cooking a lot with silicone cookware, bakeware, and she's wondering if you guys do and if you think it's safe to do so. You know, historically, there's been a lot of, you know, cook with this, now don't cook with that. So she was just wondering what you guys felt about the silicone bakeware.
For me, I feel exactly the same way as what you just described. I use it because they're telling me it's good, right?
Yeah.
And I want to believe somebody. Supposedly, the technology and all that is all good. But I do have a little suspicion in the back of my head that just like plastic cutting board, 25 years later, we're going to go, you know, actually,
it leaches stuff or
Let's do something else. Let's go back to parchment paper.
Parchment paper, exactly, yeah.
Because we know what that is. And we know what that does.
I use a lot of parchment paper. I love it. Yeah.
But, and we don't really know. Parchment is impregnated with something, so it's we don't know if that waxy substance is bad for us.
We know that no one has come out and said, don't use parchment paper anymore because people are dying from it. But we do know that some products have done that. And again, this is a new product on the market. The silicone craze is no more than 10, 15 years old. I think that the next 10 years will buy you your answer.
What about you, Tom? Do you use it?
We do use it. Matter of fact, the new donut shop that we consulted on with Nordstrom in Manhattan is going through tons and tons of sheet pan size donut silicone trays. We're serving about 2,500 mochi donuts a day there. And so without those silicone mats.
Wait a minute. 2,500.
100? Yeah, exactly. Those silicone donut mats come in awesome.
Yeah, so. Everything pops out so clean and easy.
And if you want to see what they look like, go to a company like JB Prince, JB Prince online, and they have lots of cool commercial baking stuff. So, and you'll see what the opportunity is. There's some Teflon versions of the same thing, or there's these silicone versions. So I personally try not to use them. I'd rather use a wood spoon than a silicone spatula, right? I'd rather use parchment paper than a silicone cake mold. Who knows?
But it is what's available in the market now for all commercial.
And in every shape you can imagine.
Oh, yeah. You have every shape of any kind. And JB Prince is the king store of the country for baking goods and baking supplies.
I tend to use it for, like, when I'm doing, like, little miniature little things that just – because otherwise it's – more difficult to get those things out.
Yeah, exactly.
They have sheet pens, sheets with 80 madeleines on it, or, you know, things like that, so you can do commercial sizes.
And when they do stick with the 80 madeleines, it's a long time to clean your mat. Just saying. Thank you, Jan, for jumping in there. All right. Cher Bird Garfield finally decided to brine something. She put several thick bone-in pork chops in a brine. And Brian, for 1.5 hours, when cooked, they were rubbery and weird textured. Yuck. Where did I go wrong?
Well, 1.5 hours is a bit slow. It's a bit low. I would go probably a little bit longer, number one.
For a pork chop?
Well, I mean...
They're only, an inch thick.
Oh, I was thinking like...
You're thinking a pork roast or...
No, like a pork chop, like a big pork chop. Like the one we use at Luke.
Okay.
We do that and we brine them for longer than that.
Okay, so maybe longer.
Maybe longer. The toughness. What's
the obvious thing that she did wrong?
Well, she probably overcooked it.
Overcooked them, yeah, exactly.
That's the number one thing that comes to my mind.
Because everyone wants to take pork to 165, like every book says, right?
So it's so sad.
And we can't say it on the air, really, or shouldn't say it on the air to take it less than that, but that's a personal choice.
We're not supposed to say what we're going to say next, so you should stop.
I would tell you that I wouldn't cook that pork chop me at home. I wouldn't cook it more than 130 degrees in the center, 135 maybe. It should be a little bit rosy pink for me. Now, the health department would tell you very much differently, so don't mix up the two, my saying and the health department's saying. Okay?
The health department is covering themselves. We're doing the same thing.
Okay. I will say I made the most delicious pork chops the other night. They were a Nyman Ranch bone-in pork chop, so it still had the baby back rib on it, and it was up from the by the shoulder, so you had some of the dark meat left on it. It was unusually beautifully marbled, and they came out perfect.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of keeping that part of the pork chop on, because a pork chop by itself is just basically the loin, but keeping the fat and the top cap on it makes a very different pork chop.
All right, so Susie, this is our last one. We got to go fast. Susie Flores Cummins, I have some baby bok choy, cauliflower, and zucchini. Any ideas for a dish for dinner? For a protein, I have some halibut and some sole.
I roast the cauliflower. I will steam the baby bok choy with the halibut, you know, spices and everything into the steamer. And the zucchini,
save for another day.
Save for another day.
Yeah.
If you wait long enough, you'll be able to throw it in the compost bin. No, just kidding. You could make a quick shredded zucchini salad.
Well, Chef, I personally think you're all over the place on that. I would just do a stir fry with all three vegetables, steam your halibut over a little aromatic steam of sake, ginger, garlic, maybe a little orange, and serve have a super healthy stir fried veggie with the fish on top.
Yeah, because my steaming is not healthy enough.
No, well, you roasted the cauliflower, you put your bok choy with the halibut, your zucchini you left for the compost bin. You're just all over the place on that one. All right, up next, to peel or not to peel on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. I got two thumbs up from Sean Tu. And the chef in the chapeau and I are standing amongst a lovely group of listeners here that have joined us for the morning. You too could join us. It's $20. Comes with a breakfast sandwich and hot coffee. Get to sit with us.
Best deal in town in the morning for sure on Tuesdays.
What else do you have to do on Tuesday? Like go to work or something?
I know. Yeah. On a foggy morning.
It was so foggy. All the foghorns. I could hear them off the water this morning. It was super cool. Okay, to peel or not to peel. Tina, why don't you jump in here with us? Tina's our producer here from Large Media. Has been with us since we started the show pretty much, except for your foray to New York City.
Yes, I did have a foray.
Foray.
And I had a foray, I did.
Never forget, we rescued you.
You most certainly did.
Disney Radio, we're all ears.
You did.
Nightmare. Yeah.
I could still be talking to 3-year-olds on the radio if it weren't for you guys. Kind of silly story I found on BuzzFeed. And about controversial things, whether or not you peel or not peel things before you eat them, and which things you do and don't peel. I thought people might be interested to hear what you two think of these little things. Would you like to play?
Yes, I would like to play.
Okay, let's start with the peach. You get a fuzzy peach from the grocery store because it's July.
Mm-hmm.
And are you peeling that before you eat it, or are you just going right in?
I'm not peeling it if I'm eating it and it's perfectly ripe. I will just rinse it off on the water and just dry it and eat it.
Ew.
I love the fuzz on the peach.
Yeah.
I don't.
I think it reminds me I'm eating a peach. When I was a kid, we used to have a peach tree. We definitely didn't peel anything when I was a kid. So,
unfortunately, that fuzz also holds on a bunch of stuff from the process. So if you're not in an organic garden, you probably have a lot of pesticides. You should definitely wash it off or peel it. I think peaches and strawberries are considered the dirtiest fruit.
Now, when you cook with the peach, though, or the strawberry, are you peeling or not peeling?
Always peeling.
Always peeling. Yeah. Okay. That's appealing to me.
Yeah.
Cucumber.
Good.
What about cucumbers?
If it's a nice, tender, young cucumber, not peeled. If it's an older cucumber that you buy that's pretty big and the skin is really tough, peel. That would be my guess.
Yeah, and they can get a little tannic or bitter.
Yeah. Most importantly, it's chewy. You know, it becomes leathery when the skin gets old.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to peel that off.
Just like me. I am very leathery right now.
I'm going to move on.
We'll peel him.
How about carrots? When you're cooking them or eating them, you peel them first or
no? I just scrub them and that's it.
Yeah, I agree. Especially organic ones.
Yeah, not peeling. All right. Okay, pumpkin seeds.
What?
Compost bin. Do
you just eat them whole, or do you like?
I don't. Compost bin. Maybe I could repeat that.
I have a horse in the backyard.
Well, sure, you throw them in the compost.
The ones that you get in the pumpkins from us, like the pumpkins that we see in the grocery store. To me, they're not very appealing, even when they're roasted. So now sunflower seeds, I crack the cover of the sunflower seed before I eat the seeds.
You don't eat the whole thing.
No.
But pepitas that you find in the little green seeds are much more edible and perfect.
So. All right. How about sweet potatoes?
Me?
Yeah.
I'm a leave the skin on like a baked baked potato, but a sweet potato, I eat the skin and all. Really delicious.
Is there ever an occasion where you might peel it?
Sure.
If you're making a shredded, you know, if you're making a pancake or whatever, I would definitely peel it because it's going to be a lot easier to do. Mm-hmm. That's the number one reason.
Why is that easier? If well, when you shred it, the skin gets shredded at the same size.
Again, we go back to the same thing. Depends on the age of your sweet potato. If it's freshly collected, the skin will be thin and tender. If it's been stored for a while, it will dry out. Yeah?
Yeah. I was waving to the mussel and clam man making a delivery. Raul.
Mr. Penko.
What happened?
Anyway, so on the sweet potato, I would also say that on regular potatoes, I peeled my first regular potatoes in eons the other day when I was making clam chowder for my freezer, and I just didn't want the skins to come off in the chowder. It's a little bit like peeling a tomato. You don't really need to, but when you boil it in a soup or like a minestrone or something, if you don't, then the skins are going to separate, and you're going to get those little bits of skin in your mouth, and that's I didn't want that in my chowder.
So yeah, it's the same thing for me. I don't normally peel potato if I'm doing potato rissole, like sauteed or whatever, but if I'm going to make a potato salad, I will peel my potato, only because I don't want that skin to be hanging around in my salad, or it's just not nice to eat. Plus, I just like to peel my potato for potato salad.
Well, if you cook your potatoes correctly, Chef, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't.
Your skin doesn't peel off from the salad perspective.
What is that correct way?
Tom, it depends.
Slow and slow. A simmer and not a heavy boil when you're boiling your potatoes.
Absolutely.
You're just simmering, and then you cannot overcook them. As soon as you overcook them, the skin's going to start to separate.
It just depends on what kind of potato you use, sir.
Yes. So that's a red potato. We'll say little red small new potato or a little small Yukon potato. The big russet potatoes, you have to peel because you can't cook the center without overcooking the outside.
Oh, so you have to peel those. Okay, good. I just want to make sure I got a point somewhere.
Hey, we come from different backgrounds. We have a lot of different ideas
of course,
on how to do things.
Yeah, there's no right or wrong answer.
Just because I'm challenging you on some things doesn't mean that you're absolutely wrong. It just means you're probably wrong.
Okay, no, you guys.
Just kidding.
Not absolutely, but some.
All right, let's move to apples.
Apples.
When to peel, when to not peel?
I peel. Most of the time I peel my apple.
Even if you're just going to, you know, eat it like you're holding it in your hand?
Too old to eat it? No. I don't peel a lot of things when I eat. Mm-hmm. I wash, you know, I just rinse it off. But I'm not a big, you know, I grew up eating the fruit the way they were. So I don't have a big thing on that. But to bake, for example, if I'm making a tarte tatin, I'm definitely going to peel my apples. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want that skin to be in there again for the same reason. And also I'm trying to soften them down and mush them a little bit. So I don't want that skin to be part of the thing. If I'm making an apple tart, it's the same thing. I'm going to peel them and slice them super thin and fan them all over my tart. And that's going to be a peeled apple.
You know, I think that it's really a style or probably a way right now where you're seeing much less waste. I think chefs are very conscious of trying not to waste the whole broccoli stem, right, or the whole core of the cauliflower or even the leaves of the cauliflower. There's nothing wrong with them. The apple, throwing away all that. You know, when you peel an apple, you're generally not just taking the skin off. You're taking a lot of apple, too. Same with a carrot, right? You might be taking 1/20th of the carrot off with the peel.
I'm not throwing anything away. I'm just not using it in the tart. The peel,
well, you're composting
the peel
it.
And the core go into apple cider and go reduced and go make into a glaze for the tart. Tom.
I am just rolling my eyes right now. I'm sure every time you eat an apple, you're making apple cider.
Absolutely. Every single time. Apple cider. No, I put it in apple cider. In raw apple cider, and then you make a nice glaze, a little sugar, and you get that for your tart.
Okay.
And then it's flavor, Chef.
I think the point is that I think you're seeing much, you know, chefs trying to get to a more of a zero-waste situation. When I was a young chef and I would stage in a New York kitchen or even in a European Parisian kitchen, they would take things like a 1 pound celery root, right? And they would chop it so that it was square so that they could make perfect dice and throw away close to 50% of that celery root. It's wasteful.
Of
it's
course.
Unnecessary. It's expensive. But they got the perfect little cube on the plate. So I think you're seeing much less of that these days.
You're not seeing that. I don't think you're seeing that anymore in any conscientious chef kitchen. Because people are aware. You know, there is a lot of awareness about no waste and all that.
Mm-hmm. I bet you're wrong. I bet in some of the starred kitchens you're seeing that still.
Really?
Yeah. That would be my guess. Okay, Tina, what else you got for me?
Kiwi. Do we already do kiwi?
No, we didn't do kiwi
Let's talk about kiwi.
We didn't do kiwi
There's
for a reason.
There's got to be zero occasion to leave a peel on a kiwi. Zero occasion.
Well, certainly from the standpoint, I have a kiwi tree in my backyard. I have two, as a matter of fact, a male and a female, because that's how you get kiwis.
You're farm at Prosser, you have kiwi?
No, in my farm in Ballard.
Oh, what? Really?
My house in Ballard.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Go on.
Well, I have kiwi, I have persimmon, I have apple, I have pears. I have all
I didn't know
sorts
we
of stuff in my
kiwis
backyard.
Here.
Yeah. They're very hardy, and they have nice foliage, and they grow like weeds. They're sort of a vine. Anyway, so yeah, there's really no reason to leave the skin on the kiwi.
Never.
Never? Come on.
Never.
It's not going to hurt you any.
No.
Once you wash it.
What if Tom gave you $100?
Oh, I definitely would eat. I do a lot of things for $100. I'm not that rich. I'm easy.
So when you're peeling a kiwi, sometimes it's easiest to quarter them and then scoop the skin out like you might a wedge of melon, take the skin off a wedge of melon. Mm-hmm. But you can also peel it with a peeler. But then again, you get into that situation where you're taking a lot of kiwi. Depending on your peeler, you're taking a lot of kiwi with the skin.
All right. I think we have time for one more. Brittany Bartleben is going to talk about this later, but pears, she'll talk about pears later. What are you doing with a peel on a pear?
Oh, man, a good pear, I'm not peeling either. A good Anjou pear or Commis, man, if it's perfectly ripe, it's so delicious. You know, it's just, I don't peel. Don't peel.
I would agree with you, but one of the things I've learned about having a farm over in eastern Washington, and we have an orchard, we have all kinds of fruit trees, there is nothing better than pulling that fruit in the mid-afternoon sun and eating a warm, ripe pear, a warm nectarine, a warm, drippy peach. It is something to behold, and I would suggest that for anyone who's never done it. Pesticides and all.
It's going to make you good.
All right, it's time to talk turkey. It's getting to be that time of year. We're going to do some things out of our notebook for you here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show right here on Cairo, right from the Hot Stove Society here in downtown Seattle. And it's time for us to talk turkey a bit. Chef, have you ever made a turkey?
Many times. My wife requests a turkey for Thanksgiving almost every year.
Really?
Yep.
What does she request? Almost every year. So what does she request in the off years?
No, because when I started cooking Thanksgiving dinner for a bunch of people, I was making pheasant and quail. And, you know, I was like, I'm not going to do turkey. I'm just going to do something else. And duck, you know.
So you're disrespecting the turkey as it wasn't good enough for you.
No, I was just trying to diversify, which is what we all do in this country. So I was trying to do that.
So that would suggest that you have turkey all the time, that you needed to try something new.
I've had turkey many times on the farm when I was a kid. And it was
Is that
always,
true?
Yeah.
Wow, that's
turkey.
Super cool. Did you kill them?
Oh, yeah, easily.
Mm-hmm.
They're not very bright of an animal. They don't run away. You know, them and the guinea fowl. Oh, my God. The noisiest bird on the farm. You were so happy to kill those. It was so... I mean, to eat them. You have to kill them to eat them.
We have a guinea fowl that my mother-in-law and Jackie have named the follower because it's like a puppy dog. It just they will never harvest that bird.
Yeah. And they make a lot of noise. They're very noisy.
Yeah, it's okay.
But anyway, they were delicious to eat. That's all I can say. But
okay,
I do make turkey. Yes.
All right.
And the first year I did turkey, as a matter of fact, which is going into the segment we're talking about from Kendra, our listener. You know, that's asking, she's going to butcher her, she's going to debone basically her turkey and use all the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
The first year I did a Thanksgiving dinner, my turkey was butterfly. There was no cage.
You ate a
left.
Butterfly.
I butterflied the turkey and I used four different pieces, the legs, the two legs and the two breasts. And that's how I made my turkey. My turkey was made in 40 minutes. So if you're in a hurry or you're late, it's a great way to get around putting the birds in the oven. Oh, my God, I only have an hour left. Man, you can butcher the bird, and it will cook a lot faster. Now, you have to be careful. This is still a turkey, so you don't want to sear the turkey and just keep, like, searing the turkey for an hour because you will have a dry bird on your hand. So you have to think chicken breast. You know, when you buy chicken breast and you're trying to give that skin side a nice little sear, after that you need to cool off a little bit and, you know, just slow down a little bit and don't go so high on heat. Finish in the oven, and don't be afraid to put a piece of parchment paper over your turkey so it will stop the heat from being beating on it and drying it out. The heat will still be around and will still act not like a steaming, but like an oven, basically. And but it won't be beating on it straight down, so it won't dry it up. But in a breast of turkey, a 12-pound turkey, a breast of turkey does not take more than 40 minutes to cook. So you can have your turkey on the table within an hour.
So you referenced Kendra Howe, and she's thinking of breaking down my turkey and cooking the parts instead of the whole bird for Thanksgiving. So that's why you're going that to that
correct.
So I don't think it's a bad idea what she's trying to do.
No,
I think it's kind of fun. Yeah.
I think if you're in a home, you know, often enough, the 12-pound turkey, which is usually the smallest turkey you can buy, that can be cumbersome, especially if you're only four people or whatever. Mm-hmm. It can be a serious amount of thing in the oven, and it can be cumbersome leftovers. You know, you butcher it from the beginning. And then the cool part about this is you now have two breasts and two big legs, so everybody can have a little bit of each of the meat.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest, you just freeze some of it because you're not going to get to it as a, let's say you're a couple, you're not going to get to the other 7 pounds of meat or 6 pounds of meat that are left. So you make it into small packages and put it in the freezer.
I don't think that's, well, personally, I didn't take that as her question. The question is, if you're going to do this and still serve it for Thanksgiving, what are some ideas of how to rearrange that Thanksgiving dinner that might be interesting? So to me, I would take the legs and the thighs and I would make turkey ossobuco out of it, right? Sear them real hard, get brown on the skin, and then braise them with some vegetables and some turkey stock and end up making a beautiful kind of fall off the bone thigh and leg. And then for the breast, I would pull them off, and then I would make a roulade out of them, right?
Oh,
so
nice.
I'm going to take the breast on the backside. I'm going to cut them, put the skin side on your cutting board, and cut them one direction through the flesh to open up like a butterfly. And then if it's still pretty thick, do that once again so you have this long piece of turkey breast.
Yeah, so you're looking for an eighth or a quarter of an inch thick.
Yeah, exactly.
Basically.
So then I'm going to make on the side, I'm going to make, say, maybe a turkey, a bacon and dried apricot jam. And then I'm going to not jam as in super sweet, but just dried apricots, that sweetness level.
Mm-hmm.
And grind up the apricots, grind up the bacon, and make cook up the bacon in the bits, add them back to the ground apricots, and make this jam. And spread it out on my turkey with fresh herbs, roll it back up, tie it up with some butcher twine, sear the top to get brown on the skin, and then just bake it for the 40 minutes, like you said.
Yeah.
It doesn't take much longer than that to break
it.
It
won't even take
breast.
40 minutes, not in a roulade.
So you could do that on its own. If you go to the store and you just buy the turkey breast, that would be
right.
A fine Thanksgiving dinner,
right.
Something of that sort. So that's kind of what I was thinking. So then I would take that breast. I would serve it with the braised thigh. So now you've got two kind of donenesses there.
Sure.
It makes it kind of interesting. As far as the liver goes, not much
it
there.
It doesn't deliver.
It doesn't deliver. That's it's terrible, Chef. The giblets and things like that might be fun to kind of – I would take them up and I'd take the silver off the giblets.
Yep.
And I would break them into small little cubes, bread them and deep fry them. And that would be a nice third way to kind of have the giblets
sure.
and the heart along with your leg, your braised leg, and your roasted turkey breast.
Yep.
So those, and then, of course, the rest goes in the stock to make gravy. You have to have gravy for your stuffing and your taters and all that good stuff. So that's kind of how I would approach that.
That's cool. I like the idea of making different style of meat. Onto one, using different craft, different
in
recipes.
In one bird, yeah.
In one bird. That's
mm-hmm.
very cool.
The other way to do that would be to take those legs and thighs, debone them, grind them, and make a little turkey crepinette.
Yeah.
Either with caul fat, which is the stomach lining from a cow, make a little crepinette with fresh herbs, or make just a link sausage, right?
You could
little
even
turkey
make a pate
sausage.
If you want.
If you're
going to
make turkey sausage, though, I think you have to add cheese or some other kind of fat that's going to stay in there while you're cooking it.
Yeah, fat.
Or else it's going to be just a dried mess.
Yeah. And same thing if you're making a pate. Make sure you put at least 20% fat in there because you're not going to have enough fat. It's going to dry out. But these are all great ideas to different ways to use your different pieces of the turkey. Same
mm-hmm.
with the the bones, obviously, you're making a stock, you know, which you can use for your gravy, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
But there is, you know, the legs can be made. You could also take the legs and take the thigh bone out and stuff that leg just like you would do for the
breast.
The breast,
yeah.
And then stuff it with that same farce and then wrap it up in crepinette or tie it up and then cook it gently in brown butter.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes begs the question of what are you doing with your turkey this year?
I haven't put any thoughts into it yet. I'm waiting for the turkey to arrive. Then I'm going to start thinking Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. I'm probably going to brine it like I do every year. 24 hours in a mm-hmm. big bucket in my cellar and I use, you know, just a regular brine, salt, a little bit of sugar, spices, and water.
Mm-hmm.
And then I dry the turkey out. I take it out. I usually do it 2 days before, and then I dry the turkey for 1 day. I hang it. So it comes out of the brine. I rinse it off with cold water, and then I hang the turkey to let it dry really, really well, because I don't want any moisture on that turkey when I'm trying to seal this, to roast the turkey to have a nice crispy skin. And I'm a big fan of trying to sear the side of the turkey. So I have a big roasting pan. I put some duck fat or some bacon fat that I have left on my counter, because I always have a jar, an old jar of Bon Maman jam filled up with fat. And my fat, they're mixed. No jealousy on what fat you're going to use. They're all in there. And I put that on the bottom of the pan, and I sear my turkey a little bit on the sides. And then I put it in the oven at about 400, 425 for about 30 minutes. And then I turn it down to 325.
That sounds great. Tradition reigns at my house also. Coming up, we celebrate our immigrants of the food world on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And my favorite chef immigrant right here, sitting with me here, as we have been for so many years. Chef, there's the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project event coming up. 100 Seattle restaurants on November the 14th will be offering food and drink and 10% of their sales for the day for the www.togetherseattle.org. It's called Plus Together Seattle. And we just help people that work in our restaurants, essentially, and all over the, not just, they don't have to be restaurant people, but people that are in struggling in that area, help with legal aid and finding a way. And I thought it would be interesting for folks to hear your story about being an immigrant to our country and how that went, what it was like when you first got here. And
we'll talk
about some of the restaurants that you can go to help support the project.
Yeah, we don't have enough time to tell the whole story.
No, we don't. We couldn't even get a turkey made in time.
I must remind everybody, this is the best country in the world to live in. Mm-hmm. I don't care where you are from. This is definitely a great country. The opportunity is here. It's not called the land of opportunity for no reason. I started with $12 in my pocket in 1978 in Chicago, Illinois. I thought I spoke English, but not until I got to the airport and the guy asked me to open my suitcase and I couldn't even understand. So, no, I didn't speak English. And the first language I learned in America is Spanish. I speak fluent Spanish, and I learned it in the kitchen with five Mexicans in a French restaurant. So talking about the land of opportunity and the immigrant situation in America, I started working in Chicago, Illinois, the Midwest, the heart of this country, in a French restaurant with French operators, French chef, with Mexican. And I had to learn Spanish before I learned English, because I had to communicate to these guys who were not speaking any English, or French for that matter. So from then on, you know, just took the opportunity to be a cook. And less than 2 months later, my quick story of why I stayed in America and why I clicked on staying here. Mm-hmm. 2 months after I was in America, I went to a tavern across the street with one of the cooks, the French cook. We were sitting down at the bar having a beer. And we were speaking French. And the guy next to us, about 60 years old, you know, just tall, slender, what I would describe as an American typical male, start talking to us. And I barely spoke English. And start saying, oh, what do you guys do? You know, you're French. I love France, blah, blah, blah. We work across the street at La Fontaine. Oh, I go there all the time. I'm like, wow, you must be rich to go there all the time. And anyway, an hour later, I finally said to him, I'm sorry, but what do you do? Because that was not coming up right off the bat. But and he said, I'm a neurosurgeon. And I had to make him repeat it, because I was not sure that he actually said that. And I looked at my friend, and I looked at him, and I said, you're kidding, right? And he's like, no. And I wasn't speaking English like this. I was just like, this is a joke? And he's like, no. Because where I come from, there is no way in a million years I would have been in a bar meeting a neurosurgeon.
This is why? They don't drink?
They probably don't drink what I drink. as of today, they probably don't drink what I drink anyway.
Well, you have socialized medicine in France. Why wouldn't there be a neurosurgeon? I'm just out of curiosity.
Just because there is a thing that most people don't are not aware of, you know, especially being in America. The thing about America
the class system?
Yeah, but you don't mix. You just don't mix. There's no way in the world I would have met a neurosurgeon in a bar that would have bought me a beer.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely no way. Hmm. That would have never, ever happened.
Never occurred to me.
And it clicked on me, and I was like, oh, my God, if I can be doing this, what else can I be doing? And that's why I stayed in America. Mm-hmm. And guess what I did? I became the chef in the hat. Mm-hmm. That's big to me. No one else, but...
No, but you're now a restaurant, restaurant owner.
Right.
You're all sorts of things.
You
stuck with it. You worked hard.
Exactly. And, mm-hmm. and you know, the part that most people don't maybe associate with success, or at least to me, I don't measure success in just bank account or whatever. You know, the success part is you have to work hard. You have to work very hard. I have worked very hard in my profession, just like you have, Tom. Mm-hmm. It's like it does not come handed to you. And anybody who thinks it does... They need to recheck from part zero and start again because mm-hmm. there is nothing that's handed to you. I don't care who you are. You have to go get it. So it doesn't matter where you're coming from. But because I'm an immigrant and I started with $3 in my pocket, I had nothing to lose. I didn't start with like $1 million. I started with nothing. So when you have nothing to lose, the road is actually, it's infinite. You know, mm-hmm. you just keep looking forward. There is no end to it. You just keep going. You just keep going because that's just what you know and that's what you have to do. I never had the thoughts in my mind that I couldn't have a roof above my head or something to eat. That never crossed my mind. I have to have those items. And I've always worked really, really hard for getting them. And bless the world for keeping me alive and healthy
exactly.
during those years because...
Well, you know, in our restaurants, yours and mine, we have seen immigrants come throughout the years, different waves, different points of time. I think the most influential one, culinary-wise, was the Vietnamese immigration mm-hmm. after the Vietnam War. Look at around the city of Seattle and the amount of Vietnamese restaurants. Those are direct links back to that era when those
right.
folks all came and worked in our kitchens and immigrated from the camps in Thailand. And, you know, it's really an interesting thing, even how it's influenced my cooking. But that happened throughout my history of cooking with immigrants is that
right.
I've learned so much and have taken so much from getting up and showing up every day. I think I had that already, but getting up and showing up every day is when people say, how come you're so successful? That's the number one thing I say is that, and you mentioned it too, just that get up and go,
yeah.
go get it attitude. So there's many restaurants around town that are supporting this project on November the 14th. Including Agua Verde, Bakery Nouveau, Ballard Pizza Company, Luke Bistro, which is yours, Mom Noon, Molly Moon's Ice Cream, Mountaineering Club. I mean, just all sorts of places.
Restaurants and all mine.
Look it up. I don't think all of mine are in it. Carlisle Room is, but, I mean, 10% is a big number. So
yeah.
Look up. If you go to www.togetherseattle.org, you can sign up to join either as a restaurant or... to join and go out and support this on November the 14th. It's super fun. Sawyer's going to do it out of Ballard. It's one of the hot restaurants in Ballard. Terra Plata, one of my favorites up on Capitol Hill. There's so many, many, many. So if you want to learn more, go to About Plus Together Seattle, togetherseattle.org, or you can go to our Facebook page and learn a little bit more about it. Up next, it's sumo time right here in the Seattle kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. This is the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're right here at the Hot Stove Society. Thank you for joining us. We have a special time. We're going to, you know, we always talk food and wine on this show, and there is certainly no bigger enjoyment of food and wine than probably a sumo wrestler would be my guess, or a former one at that. Kona Ishiki. Did I
get
that right?
You got it right.
Wow. How about that?
Sounds Russian, but it's Japanese.
Yashokichi.
Yep, that's my real name.
Is here. I couldn't even say your real name.
Saleva'a. Saleva'a.
Saleva'a.
Atisanoe.
You know, when you watch Husky football, you see all these Hawaiian names or the
exactly.
Brigham Young team.
Actually, that's Samoan names. I'm Samoan.
Oh, you're Samoan?
Oh,
yeah, I'm 100% Samoan.
Oh, how about
and
that?
Most of your NFL players that make it to from UW are Samoans.
Right.
The kid Via Vita that played this weekend.
Oh, my God, he was awesome.
Oh, he was He was making Seattle scared this weekend.
Yeah, no kidding.
He's Samoan.
Yeah, oh, yeah. So. I think I've always understood him to be Aviha Veha, right?
Yeah.
He used to play for the Huskies. Yeah, yeah. he was tremendous. Anyway, you're in our kitchen.
Yeah, I love to
and,
be here.
And tell us about you. And I remember reading about you when you were coming up as a non-Japanese sumo wrestler and breaking through the ranks there, which is very difficult to do. And so tell us a little bit about your story, and
okay,
then we'll get into what you eat every day.
I started in 1982 after high school, after a week of graduating from high school. I got approached by somebody from Japan to try to do sumo. And I finally said yes after the fit meeting because I didn't know anything about sumo. So since 82, I went to Japan in 82, started my sumo career. I did sumo for 16 years as a professional, and I was a champion for seven and a half years. Mm-hmm. And I actually hold the records for the fastest to make it from zero to the top rank, 8 tournaments. It take a regular guy maybe 30 tournaments, which is 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Took me a year and a half to make it
nice
to the
job.
Top. And then I still hold the record for the fastest to make it a junior champion. So my career lasted about 16 years. I've been retired 21 now. After retirement, I do TV. My main source of income, I'm an entertainer. I actually perform all over the world. I've been invited by the King of Dubai and been to Turkey and all over the world performing with my wife. We do actually some Hawaiian show. We do Japanese shows in Japan. And then I do a TV show in Japan, children's show. Been doing it for 17 years. I actually DJ too. I've been doing radio for 21 years now. And got a busy life. And then I have a guy who's sitting next to me, Sam, who kind of rushed into my life this year. I think it was January we met up and was talking about doing some sumo thing here in Seattle, and this is where I am now. Past weekend was a great success. Thank to all the Seattle people that came out and support the event. I wanted to just come in and educate people about our sport. People think it's just big guys, but sumo is one of the hardest sports, I think, in the world to get into.
Mm-hmm.
Because about 100 kids join every year, but only 20 of them really stay. They can't handle the sport.
It's like
they
football.
Quit. It's worse than football.
Oh, is it?
Well, in America, you get to go home.
Yeah.
In America, you have contracts. America, you can go and beat up somebody in the street and come back and play again.
Right.
In sumo, they don't accept nothing. Once you get out of hand, even if you're in a club with your friend and your friend gets in trouble and you're there, you get kicked out of sumo. You don't care if you're Michael Jordan or you mm-hmm. or you're LeBron. You get kicked out no mm-hmm. matter what.
It's a very traditional sport.
Very,
yeah.
Because you carry the culture more than mm-hmm. it's,
right.
it's not even looked at as sport. It's more a culture that we have to represent. And the kids are committed, meaning that 365 days of your life is sumo. And there's no season, so it's 6 major tournaments a year. Between tournaments, we have major tours that we do between tournaments. So our life is actually committed 100% to sumo. And because it's under the government's watch, we have to really represent where we go, wherever we go, watch how we behave. Behavior in public is super important. Mm-hmm. The way we dress, the way we act in the public takes a lot of pressure on us who as sumoers. Because
mm-hmm.
you want to go out and party, but you got to watch how you party. So when I was in sumo, I kind of partied with all my friends who owned the clubs because they would protect me from mm-hmm. the public.
Right.
They just have us in the corner and just go crazy as long as we don't get involved with other people so we don't get in trouble. But that's the thing about sumo, is just commitment and you have to like respect the culture mm-hmm. that comes with it and stuff.
I'd always kind of pictured it as sumo frat houses, you know, where they kept the wrestlers and or the sumo men. I don't know if you're
yeah.
called wrestlers or not, but
sumo-tori.
Where you kind of almost like a school that you go back to and you maintain a lifestyle, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's 100% school. You learn how to cook. You learn how to clean. You learn how to wash. You become like a great server
mm-hmm.
because that's all you learn. You have to learn. If you walk into my house as a sumo, you're a VIP no matter who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And we treat you like the boys that train all morning from 5 to 12, and then when it's lunchtime, you have the same boys who just bust their butts for hours to come and actually feed you. And they're the one who's making your food. So they're not allowed to even eat until your guest leaves the house.
Interesting.
So it's something that kids can take after the career, and they learn how to work. And that's one thing that a lot of kids, people don't understand. 99% of them ain't going to make it because only 60 of them can make it in the World Sumo to make it in the majors.
So, Sam, what's your role in this process here?
So, I'm just fortunate enough to partner with Konishiki. I own a production company based here in Seattle, and we produce a few different events, but Sumo and Sushi, definitely one of our favorites. And
it got so much good press.
Yeah, we had a great year. We sold out. We did almost 3,500 people through the event over a few days, and I just needed to kind of level the event up. We've been doing it for a few years, and spent a lot of time reaching out to Konishiki because we knew he was the partner we needed to have. And as he said, we flew to Hawaii in January, met him, and then Japan in July, and experienced a lot of the food culture that he's talking about now, and then it's just been smooth sailing ever since.
And so are you going to do another round of these?
We'll be back in Seattle every year, and then okay. We leave actually tomorrow morning for L.A. We're sold out in both L.A. and New York City, so we have a show in L.A. on Sunday, and then almost 5 or 6 shows in New York the following weekend, the 15th to 17th.
I was going to say, darn, I'm going to be in New York this weekend. So yeah.
Good for you.
Just missed you.
Now, serious question, because we're here to talk about food.
Yeah, man.
What does it take to become a champion like you, and what do you eat?
Well, like anything else, if you get into chef or being an athlete, you have to work your butt off, period. And then the food we eat, what we call chunko, it's like a stew. You'd be surprised. We only have 2 meals a day, which is after practice. We don't eat any breakfast. Our second meal is 6 o'clock every evening. And it contains a lot of vegetables, a lot of protein. And the reason why the boys get big is because they eat a lot of protein with rice. Rice is so important in our meals every day. But it's called chanko nabe. If you look at it, it should pop out. We can eat fish. The main dish is maybe fish with a lot of vegetables. We have like 11 to 12, 13 ingredients in that. And then the soup can be different. It can be miso. It can be salt. It can be shoyu. It can be kimchi. The kimchi. So it's one big nabe, one big pot. It's like a hot pot, but bigger. So you just have guys sitting around pot, like sticking their sticks in while they're eating rice with it and stuff. So
I can speak to the quality of that, because after we saw a sumo practice in Japan the day of the tournament, all the boys after training for hours that morning had to go and, as he said, kind of prepare a big stew, a big chanko for all of the guests, and it was delicious.
So that's amazing. Why the kids, that's the learning process. But the eating, actually, you don't really gain the weight until like maybe your second year, because as a first year sumo wrestler, there's so much responsibility. You have to take care of your seniority. It's a seniority thing. So if you're lower, you have to do all the cleaning. You have to go do all the washing. You got to make sure the boss's clothes are ready.
Yeah, so most apprentices don't gain weight.
Yeah, so once you get used to the first year, then finally you got the second year, you start putting on weight and start enjoying what you eat, actually, I think.
Well, congratulations on putting on a great show here in Seattle and sell out crowds, and I can't wait to buy my tickets for next year. Yeah, if you want to come back sooner, let me know.
We should do something here. We do some sumo chanko cooking.
I would like that.
All my sumo wrestlers are all chefs, too. That's why.
I like that. Good idea. All right, up next, we've got Brittany Bartleben, pastry chef from the Dahlia Bakery. She puts a few chunks on me. We'll be right back on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back in the Seattle kitchen. Time for our Baker's Corner with Chef Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery. And you came in feisty and raring to go.
Yeah.
You got a winter jacket on. It's foggy and cool outside.
Yeah.
And we were talking a little bit earlier in the show about the pleasure of being in our orchard in Prosser and picking some of these fruits that we are now eating that have been in cold storage, but picking some of them at the height of the warmth, even 90, 95 degrees right off the tree and just biting into them. And
one of life's pleasures.
It really is. And if you've never done it, you always hear pick in the morning or pick late in the evening or something, but there's something about some of these fruits, whether it's a warm fig or a Italian plum or pear that's perfectly ripe. The best is the peach, right? A warm peach right off the tree that is just literally dripping down your hand with juices.
Yeah.
It is the way to go. But if you can't do that, and you are now in November, and we've got our fall crops heading into cold storage, things like pears and apples, but we're also using kind of the new crop, right?
Yeah.
This is the time to be using fresh pears instead of waiting till June when they've been in cold storage
definitely
for 8 months. What are we doing with pears? How do we get the most out of them? And how do we enjoy them?
As you mentioned, this is the best time to eat the pears. So this is the best time to poach the pears, too. If you try and poach a pear in June, it's not going to turn out as well. And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
When you poach a pear, you have to use a perfectly ripe yet firm pear. And when they've been in storage, things just get a little different. Uh-huh. So this is definitely the time. For something as simple as a poached pear, they can go wrong on you, like, a lot. Uh-huh. And the first place to start is if your pear has any bruises or imperfections of any kind on them, when you poach it, it's just going to be intensified.
Yeah, so if it's got a dark spot,
it's
going to
be real dark.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yes, a perfectly ripe, perfectly firm pear. When we get our pears in, we go one step further and immediately take them out of the little tissue they come in, if they didn't come from Prosser, and then snip the stems off of them. So I don't know if you guys have bought some pears at the grocery store, put them in your little bag, and by the time you get home, they've got all these stab holes in them. Mm-hmm. And it's from those stems. So I will actually, if I'm at the store, stand there and tear off the stems in the produce
aren't
aisle.
You fussy?
I know, I'm yeah. really fussy. Yeah. So that's how you start.
I do that too sometimes.
Yeah,
I do that
yeah.
with a vegetable.
Look, I'm going like to pay for this pear.
Yeah,
I like, want it to get home okay.
Hey,
I
would just
want
to buy. The pear is so pretty with a little stem and a little one.
It really is. It's so pretty to look at, but then it stabs its brother and.
Wow.
They rot faster. I'm very, very finicky about ripening my pears.
You know how you have to buy them then? Like at Met Market, they sell those one-layer boxes.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
Where they're all separated by
yeah.
cardboard and paper.
Yeah,
so don't
yeah.
get so fussy.
Oh, I with pears, okay. They are to be babied. And don't even get me started on people putting them on top of the refrigerator or like a warm spot to ripen them. Don't do that. Just don't. Back to poaching them.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's a serious subject.
Okay.
So poaching them, you're going to want to poach them in a...
Can I stop you for
yes.
one second? Because you haven't told us what kind of... There's when you
yeah.
go to the grocery
mm-hmm.
store, there's like seven kinds of pears,
there are.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's before you get to the organic department.
Yes.
Some pears are a little mealy by nature. Like
mm-hmm.
I think of a Bosc
pear. A Bosc is mealy, yeah.
Are there pears you like to poach and not like to poach?
I like to poach Bartlett pears, but they're the hardest ones to poach because they're softer and they're more delicate.
Uh-huh.
But when they're poached, man, when they're perfectly poached, they're just like butter.
Okay.
They're so good. A Bosc pear poaches beautifully because
right.
even
yeah.
when it's ripe, it's nice and firm.
Mm-hmm.
A Comus pear or an Anjou pear also poaches nicely.
Yeah, they do poach well.
Yeah.
I'm with you. I'm not a big poacher of the Bartlett mainly because I wait till they're totally ripe.
Yeah.
Then I peel it and then I slice it super thin and use them.
They don't need
is.
To be poached if they're
yeah.
perfectly
mm-hmm.
ripe. Yeah, but they do get really delicious when they're poached.
Okay.
So that's what I go with. And then it's also in how you handle the pear. I always cut my pears in half to poach them, but it is really dramatic and beautiful to leave it whole and peel it and leave the stem on. But I think it's easier to cut them in half, and then you can get in there with a melon baller. I should say I've never used a melon baller to ball melons. I always use them to get the seed pouch out of the pears. And then you take a paring knife and cut that sort of fibrous stem out of it. And then I actually very gently toss them a little citric acid. If at home you can use lemon juice, to sort of acidulate them a little bit to discourage them from turning brown. And then from there it's kind of like treating it like a piece of fish.
Mm-hmm.
So you want your poaching liquid to be at a gentle simmer. You're going to slowly slip your pears into that water, let it come back up to a gentle simmer, turn it down, and then you need to keep them submerged the entire time. If any little bit is popping out of the water or the poaching liquid, that's going to turn brown.
Mm-hmm.
So
do you always use water? I always use like wine and sugar and a vanilla
I should
bean
say
or
liquid.
Liquid.
So you want your liquid to be like one... like 4-to-1 liquid to sugar. And I don't necessarily always use wine, but usually. So, it's not pure all wine. So you cut it with a little bit of water because
mm-hmm.
why would you waste all that wine?
Mm-hmm.
A red wine pear is nice because it hides any imperfections if there are any. But white wine, verjus, you could add some brandy, mm-hmm. some apple cider. It's your poaching liquid is yours to personalize however you want. Spices, mm-hmm. vanilla bean. I love a bay leaf in there, some star anise.
I think it's nice to think of what you're going to do in the future with that
yeah.
liquid and then make that appropriate
yeah.
for that. So if you do a red wine, you can actually reduce that down to a glass at the end and then you'll be sprinkling that
that's
over
what I
your,
was going to mention
pear.
That. Your poaching liquid is delicious. So
yeah.
once you've poached your pears in them, first of all, let your pears cool completely in that liquid just to drink up as much of that delicious flavor as possible. Then remove your pears and then reduce that liquid. I think a pear in red wine that you've reduced the liquid over vanilla ice cream is just
yeah.
so
oh, even
beautiful.
With cheese, it's delicious.
Yeah.
It's
so poached pears is not only... It's the basis for really classic desserts, such
mm-hmm.
as, you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation of this, chef, Poire Belle Hélène.
Poire Belle Hélène.
Belle Hélène. So simple, so
elegant.
We do
it every year. Once a year, we do it at Luc.
I'm considering trying it at Dahlia because it's just...
It's so simple, it's so it's part of those. It's just like peach melba, you know. It's the same concept.
Yes, it's one of those similar.
You're using the fruit in season. Mm-hmm. You lightly poach them, and you keep them in that syrup. And then when you need it, you drain it, mm-hmm. and you put it on top of vanilla ice cream with a nice coulis of either raspberry,
sauce.
Strawberry. For the poire belle hélène, it's chocolate sauce, and then toasted almond, whipped cream, and you're done.
It's
and
so elegant.
You serve that in a nice, big, beautiful glass.
Yeah.
And it's very classic, but it is the kind of dessert you don't see anymore in restaurants.
And
it's very
sad.
Hard to find in restaurants.
What about taking them out of the dessert category and taking the sugar out of your poaching liquid and just poaching in that red wine, maybe a little spice? And then when I pull my pear out, I take an apple core and I go up and I get the core from the inside and then fill that baby with some goat cheese or something like that.
Chicken liver mousse.
Chicken liver mousse would be good, but and then you have that as your salad with chicories or something.
Absolutely.
It makes a great little savory salad.
Yeah. And it's really nice to just have in your fridge to put on top of your oatmeal or with your yogurt. It's it's really delicious.
Yeah.
But you do want to store them either way, savory or sweet, store them in that
liquid until you're getting ready to serve and if you want to reduce that sauce.
So you said you need to make sure the pear is in the syrup. What do you put on top of that to make sure that happens?
Oh, so... While it's cooking and while it's being stored in the refrigerator, cover it with parchment paper.
I use a napkin.
I was going to say, trying to think what you could use at home.
Something that has enough weight to be able to keep the fruit right below the level of the syrup.
Exactly.
So it doesn't oxidize.
Yeah.
Now, if you're poaching in red wine and you've poached your pear correctly, you don't need to worry about oxidation.
Yeah, exactly. You're fine. Yeah.
So the other thing I would say is, and maybe you have a trick for this, you really, when you're going to store in that liquid and let them cool down in that liquid, you have to pull when they're not quite done yet because they continue to cook in that poaching liquid.
Yes,
right?
So. That is another good point. And you should just be able to get a knife through them. Should be able to slip in fairly easily, and then you're good. For a Bartlett pear, that's going to happen fairly quickly. For a Bosc or even a Seckel pear, it's going to take a little bit longer. But again, keep it at a very, very gentle simmer.
So if you're going to poach a whole pear, my advice would be to take the bottom of the pear, put your corer in there like an apple corer, push in, and then come back out, take that center out, and then poach your pear with a hole in the middle, which will help facilitate the poaching evenly to your pear.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, putting a whole pear non-cored, it's a much trickier thing to do. It's a bit harder to do, especially to get the centered pot poached.
Yeah. So, one of my first jobs, we had served this whole poached Bartlett pear in red wine, and we would remove the core like that, and then once they were cooled, we would stuff that with streusel and then wrap the entire thing in these puff dough strips and bake them. Dessert doesn't often make me cry, but... The early days of my career. That's why I say, like, I don't always toot my own horn, but when I do, it's about my poached pears, because that was poached pear boot camp for me.
One last question. We only have a minute. You're at the store, and so often is the case, you're making dessert tonight, but there's no ripe pears. So are you still buying a pear and then just poaching it longer, or are you just sticking your nose up and moving away from that dessert?
I'm sticking my nose up and moving away from that dessert.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I would maybe...
It depends on how underripe.
But I would maybe toss them in sugar and roast them in the oven instead or something like that.
I love pear too much.
Yeah.
I think it's a beautiful fruit. But if it's completely hard as a rock and it's a beautiful Anjou, it just has nothing to do with what
you're
looking
for. So it hasn't developed the flavor that you
want. Exactly. The sugar is having developed.
Even if you can poach it to tender, it's still not going to have the flavor.
I mean, you can have a poached pear, but it can have less flavor. Yeah. What's the purpose?
All right. That's fair. That's fair for our pears. Thank you, Brittany Bartolave, pastry chef at the Dahlia Lounge and Dahlia Bakery. Up next, it's Food for Thought Tasty Trivia with Chef Bridget Charters in my eyesight. Or in my scope. On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio. This is Tom Douglas, chef in the chapeau, is working the audience. He's back there getting more coffee and sugar and cream. And it's time for our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. Tina, you are going to administer our challenge today. And Chef Bridget Charters, here from one of the instructors here at the Hot Stove Society, is going to take the guest chef spot.
It's been a while.
And, you know, Bridget, there's a little grinder over there that we use to make ground meat for sausage.
Chef Terry
and I are planning on putting you through the grinder.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and then we're going to have charter sausage when this is all done.
I'm actually scared because...
I know Terry's been, Chef Titty has been doing very well lately.
Exactly.
I've been listening.
Oh, you do listen.
Yeah.
So anyway, we plan on making a little force meat out of you. For pate.
Easy, Tom. We're going to lose big time.
Fine.
This is a lot of trash talking, people. Yep. Let's just start this game.
Here's how it's going to go.
Each of you will get 5 questions. Whoever gets the most correct is obviously the winner. Whoever gets the least amount of answers correct will need to give something away to someone in our audience. Today you will be playing for Jan, who bravely came up to the microphone. She's a member of our studio audience here today. She asked a question, and so you will have to give her something. She was so brave.
We're happy to.
Chef Terry, what will you give away should you lose the quiz today?
Well, the holidays are coming up, so I thought maybe brunch for two at Lule, since you'll be shopping downtown. You know, just come on up and enjoy your brunch on a Saturday or Sunday at Lule.
Delightful. Chef Bridget Charters, what would you give away?
I'm giving away 2 tickets to Thanksgiving Stuffings on November 18th. It should be fun. It's a 6 p.m. class. We're going to do about 6 different stuffings. It'll be great.
Fun.
6 stuffing at 6 p.m.
Yeah.
Delightful.
That's good.
Chef Tom Douglas, what will you give away should you lose?
You know, we're fast approaching the 30th anniversary of the Dahlia Lounge, November 15th. We're having a little party on November the 19th from 4:30 to 6 o'clock for invited guests only. And I'm going to give Jan 2 tickets to that invited guest only party. And then if she wants to come to dinner afterwards, a $100 gift card for dinner afterwards.
Wow. You want Jan wants you to lose, Tom.
Even Obama didn't get that.
All right. Who would like to go first?
I'll stop.
Chef, what makes Turkish coffee unique? Is it that it has black pepper and cinnamon added to it? Is it boiled with sugar and cardamom? Or is Turkish coffee actually a black tea with a blended with sugar? What makes it unique?
The second one.
That's correct. Nicely done. Question number 2 for you. What makes Greek yogurt different from regular yogurt? Is it because it's from goats and not cows? Is it made from skim milk after the milk is turned to cream? It has extra whey strained out of it, or is it traditional yogurt just sweetened with honey?
Number 3, extra whey taken out of it.
Very good. 2 for 2, Chef. A Boston butt is a cut of most commonly used in which kind of barbecue? Brisket, spare ribs, baby back ribs, or pulled pork? Boston butt.
Pulled pork.
Correct. 3 for 3.
Smoking.
Wow. Okay, question number 4 for you. What is the dried form of cassava root, commonly known as? You have
tapioca.
Some options. You even had options, Chef. Sotol, a relative to tequila, is different because of what? It's smokier than tequila? It's a brown liqueur made akin to brandy or whiskey, or it's not made using agave?
I'm going to go with the whiskey part.
Almost a perfect score, Chef. The answer was it's not made using agave. Chef Charters, would you like to go next?
Sure.
Chef, to bard something or barding is to do what?
To bard as opposed to larding. Yes, barding is you're wrapping the meat or roast in fat.
That is correct.
What a smarty
pants.
That was
perfect, too. It's like exactly.
I thought
we had
her there for a second, Chef.
Yeah.
She's a teacher.
This is not a joke.
She's a very, very, very professional teacher.
Merci beaucoup.
All right, question number 2. When buying the blade end of a pork loin, you know that you are getting what? A pork loin that tends to be fatty, pork loin that is drier, one that tends to be bony, or is it that it's a bit tougher?
What was the first one?
It tends to be fatty.
The blade end. It's the shoulder end, so yeah. It's leaner.
Country-style pork ribs come from there. Not leaner, I can tell you that.
No.
So you're getting a pork loin that's fatty? Are you getting one that's drier? Are you getting one that's bony?
I think she's already lost this.
No, the fatty one.
Yeah, correct. The fatty one's the answer.
Tom gave me that one.
True or false, Irish butter differentiates itself from more traditional American butter with its lower butter fat content. Is that true or false?
False.
You're correct. That's 3 for 3, Chef Bridget. Question number 4 for you. Which of the following types of flour has the highest starch content? All-purpose, bread, cake, or pastry?
Starch content. Bread.
The answer's cake.
Cake.
Ooh.
Protein, sorry. Protein.
There is still time. You'll need this one correct to tie with Chef Terry. Which of the following cannot be made with a Genoise batter? Ladyfingers, macarons, madeleines, or roulade?
The macaron.
Correct. Correct. That was easy. That's tie. That's a tie.
Wow, Tom.
4 and 4.
You need to do 5.
Time to put you guys out of your misery.
All right.
Chef Tom Douglas, you're going to need a perfect score. This first one hit really
hard.
Oh, look,
Chef Brittany Bartolome. Why don't you come over here and help me? Yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, look at that. That's my pal.
For once, I'm playing with him.
I know, exactly.
He's putting the assets on his side. I can see that. He's been talking really big, so.
All right.
Okay, your first question. What pepper is harissa commonly made with? Jalapeno, pimento, serrano, or peppercini?
What was the number?
Huh? Jalapeno, pimento, serrano,
pimento.
Or... the answer, serrano. Your next question, Chef. Allspice gets its name for smelling like a combination of 4 spices. What are they?
I think this one's for you, Chef.
All right. Let's go with cinnamon.
Yes.
Cardamom.
Yes. No.
All right.
Oh.
Do you want to try, Chef Douglas?
Let's
clove.
Yes.
Nutmeg.
What are you missing?
3. You're missing 1. And I know which
one
it is.
You said cinnamon, nutmeg, and clove.
Uh-huh.
Ginger.
Yes. Cinnamon, nutmeg, clove,
that's weird
ginger.
That cardamom's that's not it. In there. Allspice yeah. kind of smells cardamom-y to me.
Yep. Do we give it to him?
Oh. No.
Not
yet. No, it's fine. He's missing one.
Yet.
He's missing
not yet.
One.
All right. Let's keep going anyway. Which of the following is the smallest? Tangerine, clementine, satsuma, or mandarin?
Mandarin.
Wow, you are just not your day. It's not your day. Not a single answer correct with the trash talker over here. The answer is clementine.
I would blame Bartolomean, personally. I'm going to turn on my teammates.
I mean, good gracious. Question number 4. Black-eyed peas are not peas. What are they?
Legumes.
Correct.
Yay!
Wow.
Yay!
You're on the board. All right, your last question. If you see aloo on an Indian menu, what is it?
Spinach.
I'm going to give you a minute here to apologize to Chef Charters for earlier.
Chef Charters, I'm humbled by your presence.
Because guess what you did? You lost.
Congratulations, Jan. Hope you can come down for our anniversary party on the 19th. If you want to be part of the show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. The show is produced by Tina Noll at Large Media. That's L-A-R-J Media. Our sound engineer is Sean Tu. And our production assistant is Abigail Leong. Special thanks to our guest. Thank you, Jan. And our Mr. Sumo. Special thanks to our folks here at the Hot Stove Society. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com. And for only $20, you too can have a delicious Dahlia Bakery breakfast sandwich and hot coffee. Remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts or go to the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.